Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, we have bad, we have crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. We should also point out that we're sponsored today by ZipRecruiter. Right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more thing before we get started, an update and a correction on yesterday's bad martini. We had talked about reports from Eli Lake at Bloomberg that the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, had been privately telling folks he's considering advocating up to sending tens of thousands of troops to Iraq and Syria to deal with the various threats. Well, in comments with Martha Raddatz of ABC News, he has poured some cold water on that. She asked him about that on Sunday. His answer was no, and his longer answer was, well, I mean, that remains to be seen. I don't think so. I think what we're doing now is supporting partner forces in Syria in certain portions of the country, including the northeastern part of the country along the Euphrates River Valley. It's only a matter of time until ISIS is defeated there. So, Jim, not exactly a carte blanche denial, but it certainly doesn't appear to be imminent. So that's probably pretty good.
Yeah. Again, this is not a across the board. Don't worry. It's never going to happen. It's like, no, I don't really see any reason to do it right now.
That's right.
And everyone kind of leans forward in their chairs as he says that. But yeah, no, let's take McMaster at his word. And hopefully yesterday's martini didn't seem too harsh on him. But let's get on to our genuine good martini, Greg.
Yeah, it's always good to correct the bad martini in a positive direction. Let's move on to the good martini. This is courtesy of the Washington Post, which is largely beating up on a New York Times story from Monday. This is courtesy of Aaron Blake. Beware the political anecdote. The New York Times reported Monday that a key congressional district in Pennsylvania isn't thrilled with its choice of voting for Donald Trump for president. The 8th District outside Philadelphia is a quintessential suburban swing district that has the unusual distinction of voting for both Trump and Mitt Romney by the narrowest of margins the past two elections. The headline of the piece is Trump voters in a swing district wonder when the winning will start. A sample. Usually this pathway outside Parks Casino is reserved for self-flagellation, a private lament at the last 100 lost. But lately, as with any other gathering around here since late January, the checkout line, the liquor store, the park nearby, where losing lottery numbers are pressed into the mulch. Patrons have found occasion to project their angst outward, second-guessing a November wager. Just like any other darn president, sighed Teresa Remington, 44, a home care worker, and the mother of two active-duty Marines scraping at an unlit cigarette. She had voted for Donald J. Trump because she expected him to improve conditions for veterans and overhaul the health care system. Now, political bluster, she said. And they found a couple other people in that area who were disillusioned as well. But as Aaron Blake, no fan of Trump, points out, that's a pretty grim picture, and it's quite possible that it's an accurate one of this particular district. But if it is, this district is not an accurate microcosm of Trump supporters more broadly, and it's not close. The same day this story came out, the Pew Research Center released a poll showing very little buyer's remorse among Trump voters. The poll showed just 7% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents say Trump has performed worse than they expected him to. Fully 38%, five times as many, say he has performed better. There's a real sense among some that Trump has underperformed, but it's almost wholly on the Democratic side, where 32% say he's worse than advertised. So, Jim, obviously we hear all the bad news because the media loves reporting all the bad news. And we've, I think, been pretty fair on pointing out the good and the bad. But this idea that we're kind of at an avalanche here of Americans just en masse abandoning support for this president is way overblown.
You know, a couple of things jumped out about that piece, Greg. The first is that Parks Casino, I drive past it every time I go up to visit my my in-laws in Bucks County. And for starters, like if you say, I need to talk to the average voters and see, do you usually go to a casino? I mean, was there a perception? Trump voters, they like to gamble, you know. I couldn't. It seemed like a very unusual pick. And the second thing is, this is in Bucks County. This is the Philadelphia suburb. So, I believe, you know, Trump. I have to go back and check. I think Toomey carried it. I don't know if Trump carried it. If Trump did carry this county, it was by the skin of his teeth. I think he more likely he lost it narrowly. It's kind of a weird spot to go looking for. Certainly, if not your iconic Trump voter, then a representative one. Now, maybe they had the data to go back even further to know that around this casino and racetrack was a really good pocket of Trump voters or something like that. Look, on the one hand, I love these sorts of stories, Greg. It is always kind of fun just to, whether you're doing focus groups or just going out to a place asking people how they feel the president is doing, because this is not a self-selected group and you're just asking random people, you might get some very interesting answers. Now, when that woman says, "I'm disappointed because they haven't, he hasn't fixed the VA yet," well, for starters, we're not even at day 100. And the second thing, you kind of would like to drill down with some of these people and say, okay, how will you know when the VA is fixed? Does she know somebody who's collecting VA benefits? Does she know somebody who's going to a VA hospital? How does she develop her perception on how good the VA is working? I think it's a perfectly legitimate and fair measuring stick for the success of the Trump administration. I guess the other question is, how quickly did she expect to see these sorts of changes that she wanted to see happen? But again, people aren't always logical or you know, extremely well-reasoned. A lot of people look at things and kind of give a gut reaction based on these very subjective and sometimes esoteric measuring sticks. You know, if your brother-in-law who's been looking for a job finally gets one, your perception is that the economy is getting better, regardless of what the official unemployment rate is. Blake does us a good job at the Washington Post by saying, look, you anecdote reporting. Back when I was on the college newspaper, we called this a AAA story. Ask any. There was a vulgar euphemism for the part of the anatomy that starts with A that would go there. But you can just call it as ask any person, right? Opinions are like that part of the anatomy. Everybody's got one. It's interesting. It's usually fun to read. Sometimes you can get some enlightening or observing answers from people, but you don't necessarily know if these people who you're talking to are representative of the country at large or even voters in a particular area at large. You may get somebody who's particularly attuned to politics, or you may get people who really aren't paying any attention to politics. So there's only so much you can learn from those sorts of stories. And Blake does us a solid service by pointing out, look, you know, the number of people who approve of Trump right now is really not all that different from what it was when he was elected as president. I was surprised his favorable rating was only 42%. Trump was never beloved on a national scale. Yes, he won with did not win the majority of the popular vote. This is in all likelihood, it's unlikely that barring some, the U.S. forces planting the U.S. flag at the ISIS headquarters, like the raising of the flag in the Pacific in World War II, barring some sort of amazing accomplishment, it's unlikely that Trump is ever going to be a broadly beloved president. We're a very divided country, and I don't know about you, Greg, I don't see that changing anytime soon. So it's not that we should necessarily expect anything like this. When you hear stories about Trump's base is abandoning him, I'd like to see it based on a little bit more than a bunch of people who happen to be about outside the racetrack outside Philadelphia one day and just happen to encounter a New York Times reporter that day, because I don't think it's necessarily the best or most accurate measuring stick of the entire state of the country. And even if Trump is in trouble, you know, it's April 18th, Greg. He's barely gotten started. The Republican Party as a whole, Trump isn't on the ballot till 2020. They really have until November 2018 to start generating some results and say, see, this is what happens when you have Republican-controlled government. Don't you like this? Having said all that, the clock is ticking.
It is, and it's ticking today. Actually, we're on the second special House election today. It's in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. Most likely headed to a runoff. The Democrats are hoping to get their preferred candidate, John Ossoff, over the 50% line to avoid the runoff, because there are no shorter than 11 Republicans in this race. So clearly no Republican is going to get to 50% in this thing. This is the race to replace Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price in Congress. Last week, we saw the Kansas special election to replace Mike Pompeo. Democrats thought they had a chance there in the closing days. Ultimately, the Republican won it in a much tighter race than should happen in that district. And of course, the liberals suggested that was all due to Trump, but it was really more about Sam Brownback, sadly. This race is also being put out there by the Democrats as a Trump referendum. Trump doing little to discourage that, since he keeps tweeting about it. The super liberal Democrat in the Georgia congressional race tomorrow wants to protect criminals, allow illegal immigration, and raise taxes. Then he says, with 11 Republican candidates running in Georgia for Congress, a runoff will be a win. Vote R for lower taxes and safety. And then he says Democrat John Ossoff would be a disaster in Congress, very weak on crime and illegal immigration, bad for jobs, and wants higher taxes, say no. And then another quote, and then another tweet about Republicans getting out to vote, and a slam at the Democratic front runner. So if Ossoff wants to make this about him and Trump, Trump is doing it some favors here. Jim, the bottom line here, though, is that this is a House district that was held by Tom Price and even Newt Gingrich back in the day. So the Democrats even making this competitive is going to be spun pretty heavily by the media today.
Yeah, special elections, particularly in the House level, they're not enormously edifying, but they're not something you can completely ignore either. And I realize that sort of answer isn't necessarily satisfying. We you know, most people would like to know, no, I either want to totally say this is a bellwether indicator of what's going to happen in the 2018 midterms, or I want to know that I can completely ignore it. I think what's most interesting, when you have a district that skews very heavily to one party, a special election like this is when the other party, which usually has no chance of winning, can win it. I think my two favorite examples are 2010, Republican Charles Jew won in Hawaii's first district. This is the Cook Partisan Voting Index, puts it as 18 points bluer than the average congressional district. The other famous one was a Republican Robert Turner won in Anthony Weiner's old New York City district, which scored a D plus 31. It will probably not surprise you that, you know, Charles Jew ended up losing his bid for a full term the following year. That's even in the election day 2010, which was a good day for Republicans almost across the whole country. And Robert Turner chose to run for another office. I think even he could kind of see that in a presidential year, no, he was not going to win re-election to a full term in this New York City district. So really what it's a special election is probably less useful as a bellwether than an opportunity to say, okay, if I'm a minority party, I can win this seat because the circumstances of a low turnout special election are so different. Democrats gave it their best shot in that Kansas district last week. They fell short. Usually they lose by about 30. They lost by about 8. They should be pleased by that. I don't think you're going to see a 22-point swing in every district across the country next year. If you do, then Democrats will probably take the House. I think what it does say is, okay, the Democratic grassroots are fired up. Yes, they are really mad as heck about Trump. And, you know, some of them really are eager and willing to show up in a special election when they ordinarily might just ignore it. I'd be very surprised if John Ossoff doesn't get the highest total in this year's in today's Georgia special House election. He should get somewhere in the 40s. The bad news is he needs 50% to win the election outright. If he doesn't, then you go to a runoff, and it's he and the next highest candidate, which is almost certainly going to be a Republican, probably Karen Handel, the former Secretary of State, but a couple other guys could be in the mix there. If you end up with that, then in the runoff, the Republicans should have the advantage. This is a pretty heavily Republican seat. So if you're a Democrat, does this make you feel good that you're performing much better than usual, but not enough to win? Or you're looking at this saying, well, this was probably our best shot to win seats like this, and we didn't win, so we're probably never going to win them. The reason I put this in the bad martini category, Greg, is that whatever happens tomorrow, Democrats are going to walk around convinced they won something big and important, and they really didn't. Basically, they had one major Democrat running and a few other no names, and just short of every Republican in the district running on the Republican side. Which, lo and behold, when you have a bazillion Republicans running and one Democrat, guess who ends up with the biggest share of the vote?
Yeah, and he doesn't actually live in the district, so that's fun.
All right, this is the sort of thing that we can only share with Three Martini Lunch listeners, Greg. So he did an interview with CNN this morning. It didn't go well. It doesn't help that he looks like an intern. He's a very young-looking 30-year-old. But yes, he does not live in the district. He says he grew up in the district. He now lives just across the district line with his girlfriend of 12 years, Greg. Now, look, Ossoff is free to live his life however he likes. Did Mrs. Corumbus have to wait 12 years for a ring, Greg?
No, not even close.
All right. I thought I was pushing it like 6 years. So anyway, I just wonder how many people had a spit take when they heard that on national television. I hope the Ossoffs have a long, happy life and a happy marriage and everything turns out just fine for them. But I just wonder if you were watching a live dial, whether you'd see young female viewers suddenly drop at that moment. Like, oh, really? You won't put a ring on it, huh? So,
well, if he doesn't win the runoff, you can always fill his free time with a copy of Heavy Lifting, because I'm pretty sure
it's the sort of thing that Cam and I had a thing or two to say about.
12 years. So they're not really the Ossoffs yet. They're Ossoff and whatever, whatever her name is. So you mentioned that he was an intern. So in addition to reading heavy lifting, should he not win, he'll probably be looking for a job. And let's hope that's the case, because he is a hardcore lefty here. So somebody might want to hire him, probably some sort of liberal think tank or maybe the DNC. He's kind of like their darling at the moment. But the question is, are you hiring? And do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Because posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates.
If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. Now you can post your job to more than 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface.
So no juggling emails or calls to the office. Quickly screen your candidates, rate them right away, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses, too. Right now, 3 Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. We're almost to graduation season. You got a lot of people, if they haven't already, sending out their resumes for jobs they're hoping to get out of college. Sift through them quickly. Figure out which ones are the real deal, which ones aren't. ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. All right, on to our crazy martini now, Jim, and we just could not see this one coming. This is courtesy of the Washington Examiner. San Francisco's higher minimum wage is causing an increasing number of restaurants to go out of business even before it is fully phased in, a new study by the Harvard Business School found. The closings were concentrated among struggling, lower-rated restaurants. The higher minimum wage also caused fewer new restaurants to open, it found. The city's minimum wage is currently $13 an hour, compared with California's rate of $10.50 and the federal rate of $7.25. Ultimately, California's going to be going up to $15 next year. So, Jim, we talked about this when it happened in Seattle. We've talked about it other places where this $15 arbitrary minimum wage that the Democrats suddenly love. It's the same story time after time, yet we keep doing the insane thing by trying it over and over again.
You know, there are a few issues that make me I suppose things like ISIS or, you know, nuclear proliferation, chemical weapons, there are bigger fears in this world. But here's a policy that, you know, the evidence is starting to stack in. This is a pretty big job killer. This is probably something that you make labor more expensive, and companies start looking at saying, okay, how can we get somebody, a machine, to do this job instead? Because in the long run, the machine will actually be cheaper. And that's why you see, you know, I ask people, you know, when you buy tickets to the movies, do you buy it from the person behind the counter, or do you buy it at the little machines at the front of the place, or do you order them online? And more people say, well, I order them online. You know, I use my phone. I've got whatever the app is, and you punch it in and you do that. We are increasingly figuring out ways to eliminate service jobs by replacing them with technology. On the one hand, that's great. That's wonderful. On the other hand, these used to be your entry-level jobs. If you were not particularly skilled, it didn't take, you know, trust me, waiters and waitresses have a skill. Those plates can be heavy. Being behind the counter of a fast food place is not a fun job, but you can do it. And it's not like you need a degree in chemical engineering or something like that. The more people say, well, I'm just going to raise, you know, I want to raise, so let's raise the minimum wage. It feels really good to say, yeah, let's give those poor people a raise. But they don't really think through the consequences of it. And the public's collective mind seems to have a protective shield around it on this. They will not recognize the consequences of this, no matter how many times Republicans or folks on the right, free market folks, explain this. It's something where at any time a Republican takes a stance against raising the minimum wage, Democrats beat them over the head with it. This always polls really, really well. You know, maybe the best case scenario is examples like, I believe it was Seattle raised it up to $15 an hour. And I know that obviously San Francisco and California is contemplating it. But people, you know, people just want to seem to believe, oh, there's just this pot of money for most employers that are sitting on. And we can just force them to pay it out in terms of minimum wage increases, and everything will be fine. And they're not going to be fine. Unfortunately, I have no idea how to persuade people to say that, no, actually, there is a consequence to minimum wage hikes. And it usually ends up with lost jobs.
One of the things this study found, quote, we provide suggestive evidence that higher minimum wage increases overall exit rates among restaurants where a $1 increase in the minimum wage leads to approximately a 4 to 10% increase in the likelihood of exit, i.e. closing the restaurant. So, Jim, amazing numbers. Once again, proven correct. I don't think it's going to change the popular opinion on this, but the idea that employers are sitting on a pile of cash on this tax day 2017, I'm sure they would probably beg to differ with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Safe bet.
Very good. Talk to you tomorrow, Jim.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Don't forget to visit our friends at ZipRecruiter. Right now, 3 Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. Join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.